Trying to escape is futile. Who child is time to juggle is too wild. That's why we got more than two styles. To adapt to the situation, too child. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try to make smiles to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive. It is time to build a nest. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Juggle specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burn the same driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states wisdom is the principal thing. If we'll get wisdom, it's all like get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the home page, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. They broadcast out of Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program, with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media. Interesting articles that you can read and download at later times and share with your friends. Also check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Different African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 8:08 here in the city of Philadelphia on a Sunday evening. And glad to have you with us. We'll be joined by a special guest in conversation this evening, author, cultural historian, and professor of education, leadership, and policy studies at Howard University. Dr. Kenneth Shockley will be with us. The discussion will center around his new book, African-Centered Education, Theory and Practice. And you can always join in the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening at 7:13 here in the city of Philadelphia. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm definitely after being rescued. I'm definitely excited to have this discussion tonight. I think it falls into our broader discussion of, you know, just dealing with education. I'm looking to hear how Dr. Shockley's new book and the contributors to it is helping us be able to see the value and the need, necessity for African-centered theory and practice educationally.
You know, it's always good to talk about these subjects. We've had other educators on. This is a perfect time. In fact, a lot of these men have been doing work all along, so it's not like they're just reacting. It's a perfect time for our people to hear these discussions and make plans to move forward. I'm glad that Dr. Shockley could come back with us. The last time he was with us was, it might have been almost a year and a half, Richard, when
he was
documentary.
In Brazil, Colombia?
In Colombia, yeah. Yeah, the Colombia, with Brother Kofi Lanials was with him. But let's reach out to get him on. Arthur, cultural historian, professor of education, leadership, and policy studies at Howard University. Dr. Kimmett Shockley is with us. Dr. Shockley, how are you, sir?
Doing great. How are you brothers doing?
I'm doing good.
Fine.
Glad to have you back with us. With us,
important, I'm very happy to be on, yes.
Important discussion. Dr. Shockley, you know, before we kind of really get into the meat and bones of the book and your opinions of African-centered education, let's talk about the genesis of the idea behind this book. Now, and the reason I'm saying it is because you were just, as an educator, you could have just put this book together yourself and put the material out there for people to utilize it, to understand it, to talk about it, and to put it in practice. But you did something that's, I think, is very important and that we have to do moving forward, especially in the way this system seems to be coming apart at the seams. We have to work together. I see that you enlisted the help of several conscious scholars in the work that you put together here. And I see several of the names here, and some of these names have been on the program. Talk about the genesis of that idea to get not only your opinions and work, but some other conscious scholars' opinions and work and put it together in this book.
Excellent question. Thanks for asking that. In relationship to this book, it really comes from, for the past, I would say, 20 to 25 years, as an educator, first teaching young black children in the Cincinnati public schools, which is where I started off as a teacher, and then moving to the Washington, D.C. area and teaching children, and then moving into some leadership positions in education, and then getting my graduate degrees in education, and really sort of seeing what's happening to black children. And that is that they're falling victim in the system of white terror, domination, white supremacy, to the whims of white people. We don't have in that system the ability to do what we think is best for our children. And that is not an overstatement. That is the truth. If we feel as though something is best for black children in the system of education, the first thing that you have to do is you go through a system of other black people who will calm down your notion of what you think needs to happen with their Negro ways of thinking and try to water it down so that it's acceptable to the white people in the field of education. Once it goes through the Negroes and then goes through the white people, it ends up being an idea that actually has no teeth. So for the most part, what we're doing in education is trying to make sure that white folks are happy. That's what we pretty much do. So, for example, the idea of multicultural education was an idea that actually had teeth at one point. By the time the people who became the proponents of multicultural education and other ideas that are related to it got finished with it, it turned into a parade of different foods and things of that nature and what unique costumes you can wear when you come to the multicultural fair at the school, everybody having a good time laughing while black children suffer tremendously in the field of education. So over the years and sort of seeing this joke that's being played on black children, I started to realize that we're in a war of irreconcilable realities with many of the people who work in the field of education, The irreconcilable realities are that war is a war with our enemy. And so the only type of education that is really worth talking about as it pertains to Black children is African-centered education. So our enemy, our open enemy, is really oftentimes trying to convince Black people that the new, like right now, they want us to focus on anti-racism, which is a joke and a trick to get us to focus on them once again. So I wanted to elicit the help. This was way before the current so-called movement that's going on, but I wanted to elicit the help of people who I thought were very serious, who work in the field of education, Samuel Burbank's, Molefi Asante, Asa Hill, Asa Hilliard, that's my former mentor. Maulana Karanga, I always think of, get those two, I think of them in the same way. But Maulana Karanga and others, Kofi Lamoti, who was a co-editor with me, one of my mentors and a great scholar. I also have a piece in there by Joyce King. So some of the more serious scholars who are very serious about Black children to help put together something that Black parents and other Black educators who are serious can use. So that was sort of the impetus of writing this book. I really wanted to just have some conversation and some connection with those Black people in the field of education who are actually serious and are not just trying to get their next paycheck.
Dr. Shockley, I want to ask a question and get you to give your opinion, because you kind of jumped the gun with some of the statements, the initial statements you made. Tell me something, and this is my assessment. I might be wrong. Help me with this as an educator and a professional. You see a lot of people talk about Black history, whether consciously or unconsciously. That's why I've made an emphasis on you gathering African-centered scholars, because when you talk about Black history, and some of our people might not be aware that the education of just Black history might be an education towards assimilating our children, where if you're talking about African-centered education, you're talking about an education that will eventually lead to freedom for our people. Am I wrong, or am I? Help me with that.
Well, I totally understand. Teaching history to people, even if you're teaching truthful history to people, if you don't carry a lens that is revolutionary or that is liberating, then all you're doing is giving them information. What's really needed, and what I'm hearing you say, is we need the lens. We need the framing around whatever it is we're teaching becomes even more important than the facts that you're teaching. So when people aren't clear about the lens they're using to teach our children, we have to get that person out of the classroom too. So if the person knows a bunch of information and facts about Africa, but they're not willing to have the Black nationalist perspective, they're not willing to put the Black nationalism together with the truth, they can't be used either. Because what happens is they are going to get a lens from the society. So you are going to pick up the white supremacy. You are going to pick up notions related to white terror and domination and just all the idiocy that comes in. So if what you're trying to do is to be lens free and just present objective facts, you're going to have kids getting your objective facts along with the white supremacy lens that comes in every other aspect of their life. And so we're not combating the main thing. The main thing we need to do is to import into our children a notion of Black self-knowledge, self-love, and also understanding that we are at war and who the enemy is and how to fight against that enemy. All that comes through the nationalist perspective and lens. It doesn't just come through information. And so sometimes we can end up with people who, unfortunately, are so in love with information that they can become arrogant about knowing more things than the next person. But the interesting thing about that is it doesn't really do us any good as a people to just have a bunch of information. You also need to be imbued with an African-centered Black nationalist perspective that is focused on our need for a Pan-Africanist future.
Dr. Shockley, I noticed in the foreword of the book, it mentions the contributors provide perspectives on history, methods, successes, and challenges of African-centered education. Can you give a brief synopsis of those 4 points, the history, the methods, the successes, and challenges?
Well, in terms of the history, there is a really interesting piece in the book by Malefi Asante that talks about revolutionary pedagogy, and he talks about the ways that we've been working for years to get to revolutionary or a better place for our children. There's also a piece in there, interestingly enough, in the introduction by Gloria Ladson Billings that gives one of the most interesting pieces on the history of how African-centered education actually came into being. And then the other three you said were what?
The methods, successes, and challenges of African-centered. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say methods. Ama Mazama talks about methods, Afrocentric instructional practices and assessment. I think that's really an interesting piece because what she is able to do is talk about how many of our people are now starting to homeschool their children. Because the school system can't be counted on, because we know that what's happening in the education system is that Black children are being used to run experiments on, and they're turning our children against us. I have an interesting presentation where I try to draw a parallel between what would happen if you tried to teach a dog how to meow. And so a dog's not meant to meow. And so using her own examples and her own symbol, she gives an example of what is happening to our kids and why we need to really support homeschools. Some of the successes, I like Rona Frederick's piece talking about the successes of some of our best African-centered teachers. She talks about a guy named Brother Ture. Brother Ture is actually the same person that I referenced in one of my articles. I think it was back in 2010. We did some research work on the same person. This fantastic African-centered teacher who's able to get students to perform where other teachers are not able to get those same students to perform. And then I think another one that talks a lot about our great successes is one of my mentors who passed away in early January, who has now moved on to the realm of the ancestors, Nana Kwame Ajiakoto. His piece, Notes on African-Centered Pedagogy, is really just talking about, from Marcus Garvey to Dessalines to all the great people we had who came before us who have kind of led us to the place where we are now, and just gives a very deep and thorough analysis. And then finally, when we're talking about some of the challenges, I think that just in terms of math and science and some of the things that our kids are struggling with in the so-called school system, Sekou Africa is his name. And he is a math genius, a math brother who's teaching math education at Bowie State. He's a professor there and talks about some of the challenges that we have in African-centered education as well as in Black education in general.
Yeah, Brother Richard, I know because we kind of briefly kicked some things around before you came on the air with us. And Brother Richard, I know that homeschooling was one of the things that you were talking about. Jump in here with the.
Brother Shockley, I'm coming from this perspective of what Dr. Clark, the way Dr. Clark looked at it, and you, in opening, you say, being clear of who's the open enemy, be recognizing that we are at war and that there is a Black nationalist perspective. And therefore, I was looking at one of Dr. Clark's statements in can African people say themselves? And I'm trying to formulate a question for you out of this, where he says Africans must begin to produce every item essential to their survival. Education must be geared to produce the large number of technically trained Africans needed for this task, and the trained must in turn produce other Africans to replace them. So in that context, from that nationalist perspective, and I don't know if anybody addressed this in the book and, you know, in the various articles, but this is something I've been saying. I wanted to get your reflection on this. Should we as a people look at our children as a raw natural resource and a strategic asset?
Should we look at our children as a raw natural resource and a strategic asset? Well, I'm not sure what you mean by should we look at them as a raw natural resource. Can you elaborate on that a little bit so that I make sure I'm addressing what the essence of what you're asking?
And if we're looking at a nation, you have to build an economy around something, and something that you control, you ultimately control, or at least if you don't control, you're going to take control over. In this moment, we don't control land, but we do control the children we produce, and we can control how they're produced. And I think that in what you laid out in Elliot's question, what some of the authors were addressing of how we don't really control how they're being educated, because whether it be by the curriculum or as you use now, it's going to be towards racial or whatever that is that they're coming up with now. Before it was multicultural. That wasn't necessarily us as a people saying this is how we're going to produce our children to have a certain outlook that Dr. Clark said is that is essential to our survival. That's what I mean as a natural, you know, a natural resource. We birth them, and we should control how they are developed, if that makes any sense. And because of that, we should recognize that if, you know, like any nation, you secure and protect your strategic asset. You don't just let it go to somebody to be able to utilize it at their whim for their benefit.
Well, I mean, I 100% agree that we should see our children as a major asset, and we should protect our children. The number one thing we have going for us in the African worldwide community is our future and our children. So I don't think that we should see our children as being just any other thing. They should be treated in the most precious way, and they should be loved, and they should be cared for, and they should be thought of in highest regard. But unfortunately, we send them to schools, as you were kind of alluding to, where they're seen almost as small adults, small black adults. And we know how this society sees black adults. So they're sort of not thought of the same way other children are thought of, which is as sort of minor. Black kids are treated in schools almost as if they're adults. And all of the research on punishments that kids receive for being in school, they say that, you know, black kids receive three times more punishment or more higher suspension rates than kids for other kids for doing the exact same thing. So we know that there's a hostility towards black children in schools, just like there's a hostility towards black adults in schools. Yes, our children need to be taught how they're seen in the system. We also are not doing a very good job. Let me tell you something that we're not doing a very good job of in the Afrocentric schools or in the public schools, and that is teaching our children to understand the nature of what it means to be in a war. We're not really preparing our kids with the thought and understanding that the black community is in a war. And the direction of going towards anti-racism is actually harming our ability to think of ourselves as an independent people who need to move towards sovereignty, who are currently in a war. It's moving us towards thinking of ourselves as being a group that needs a better position in American society, and we need for white people to act in more fair ways. So, yeah, we have to do a better job of preparing our number one asset for our real problem, which is the fact that a war has been waged against us.
And I know it may be uncomfortable to some of the listeners in the way I'm processing this, because we're in a capitalist society, right? So we can't overlook that. And if we don't look at, others are looking at us, have looked at us, brought us in this process as a commodity, then we won't be able to put the right type of protection around what is important to us in our future, and to me, that's our children. Setting up for my next question in relationship to whether in this the theories and the practices that were written about. I apologize. I like referencing of other people's works for the ideal, and I'm looking at Slavery at Sea, Terror, Sex, and Sickness in the Middle Passage. By Sawandi Mastaking. And she says that it is not enough to say that Africans were captured, transformed into commodities, shipped out of Africa, sold to interested buyers, and turned into slaves once more into plantations. The human manufacturing process, and more importantly, the interior holds of merchant ships, served as vital sites of power sailors used to dehumanize captives, enforce dependency, inflict pain, establish authority, and prohibit any sense of control over one's personal life in the near and far future. Would you say that that is a pedagogy, or that is a educational process that continues in the public school and private school arena as it relates to African children and what the outcomes they're looking for?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's certainly missing from education is what Asa Hilliard calls the notion of deep thought. So we're not teaching our children in the schools, in public schools, how to be deep thinkers, and we are also allowing them to be socialized by people who don't like them. We're not giving them the socialization that comes from the natural and the indigenous root from which we come. So I think one of the main problems we have is that we are producing the very shallow types of people that we're looking at every day and saying, we're not with you. We're not on the same page as you. And of course, being enslaved is the thing that was used as soon as we got on those slave ships. I say in one of my pieces that the identity crisis began as soon as the first ship left the African shore. And so slavery became really the first bomb that they dropped in that part of the war that was waged against us. There were about seven major war episodes that have occurred between Africans and other people and Africans and Europeans. That was the seventh major war, according to Chancellor Williams. And when we got on those slave ships, the war started then, the war continued then from its beginning of that war episode. And then we sailed across to these various different places where we were left off. And as opposed to us thinking of that being a war that was being waged against us, we oftentimes just think of it as slavery. But that was a part of a war. And what we're into now is also part of the same war. So your question about what's the connection between what happened in enslavement and now is that it is the exact same war. And in order for us to get our children to help us to get out of this situation, we will have to teach them that our real job, our everyday job, is to get ourselves into a position where we can win the war that's been waged against us. We have to think of it as a war that started. We have to think of enslavement as being part of a war. We have to think of now as being part of a war. So I do think we should think of it that way. And I do agree that We need to socialize our children in ways that are going to actually help us to get free.
And that's why, you know, as Ellie says, you know, my thrust is looking at those parents who intentionally are by homeschooling, are putting their children by their own will and design through an African-centered educational process, because at least that comes out of the family structure process, and at least we recognize that those women and men and women are intentionally saying this. I know that my child need this in order to activate them. How strong do you see, and looking at, and I'm looking at from this nation management perspective, how strong do you see that homeschooling, that African-centered homeschooling, and did anyone in the authors, in the sense of whether the successes, speak to that, to give us a sense of how widespread that activity is going on within our community?
I do think that Sister Ama Mazama, who is a professor at Temple University, does a pretty good job of talking about, of answering that question more thoroughly than I can do right now. But it is a relatively new phenomenon. It didn't just start with the current upheaval that you see coming from Black people. It actually started some time ago. There aren't a lot of, and when we talk about homeschooling, a lot of times I think people think in a traditional homeschool where the parents teach the kids, but what we're finding now really with the Afrocentric ones, it's community homeschools. Mm. But community homeschools, well, and that's where somebody in the community is doing the homeschooling, being the teacher and this kind of thing, doing the administrative work out of their home, and people from the neighborhood bring their kids into that space and have to help pay for the different things that are a part of educating children. But what's needed in these homeschools is information. This is one of the reasons we wrote the book. What's needed is training. So you have people doing homeschools who sometimes themselves aren't dedicated to having the right kind of lens. We talked about earlier in the conversation with a Black nationalist lens, understanding what Pan-Africanism is. A person has to be first dedicated to those principles in order to transmit knowledge and information to children in the right way. You can't just be knowledgeable about history or social studies or spelling and art, et cetera. You also have to be imbued with the African center perspective in order to really do the kind of teaching. So you'll find homeschools sometimes will call on people like me, my brother Tshango and Billy Shaka, who does African centered education work and training. They'll call Chike Akua, various different people who do the kind of training on the thinking that's necessary in order to have an African-centered institution. So they have to call on people for assistance, and that's a good thing, but we do have to make sure that the homeschools that are being established under the banner of African-centered education have people running them who are themselves dedicated to those concepts and principles. And sometimes we find that to be a difficult issue, because sometimes that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes what you have coming into African-centered institutions, including the schools, are parents who want their kids to have the advantage of the African-centered education, but they don't necessarily want the kids to be imbued with the very perspective that they need so that the kids can move ahead. That's that pro-African, Afrocentric thinking. They don't want their kids to have some of that, but they want the kid in the Afrocentric school because of the benefits of the Afrocentric school. So we do face some interesting challenges.
Brother Keel Parker here in Philadelphia made the same observation to us at one point in the presentation, and when I hear your response, it kind of speaks to what Dr. Du Bois had said in 1936. That we need to systematize our homeschooling process in order to be able to address some of those challenges that you speak to. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I think that really many of the African-centered schools that were started off as institutions where people were simply educating their own children. You know, if you look at a school like Nation House in Washington, D.C., that's been around now over 40 years, that started as an institution where Kwame Aggia Okotoh and his wife Akuia Okotoh were simply trying to create an institution to educate their first child. And then a couple of other people in the neighborhood who had kids around that same age were trying to do the same thing. So the way that this is starting out right now with some of these African-centered homeschools that are being established is going to end up being those are going to end up being the Afrocentric schools of the future. Mm-hmm. We just have to help them establish themselves in the right way.
Dr. Chocolate, you mentioned to Richard in your conversation with him about us being in a war. You mentioned that when you first started, when I asked you a question, the initial question in the beginning. Let's go to that thought about the war and teaching our children the importance to understand that our people have been in a war since they've been here in this country. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's fear of some of our educators, and I'm talking about our educators, in teaching this or them not knowing? Now, let me say this, in my opinion, and I'd like to get your assessment. I believe it's more fear than them not knowing. I think that some of our educators, if they do know this or study these understandings of an African-centered perspective or worldview on our predicament, that they'll be teaching something that Europeans have told them is racist or teaching hate. If you recall, Bill Clinton waited for John Lewis's funeral to trash the memory of Stokely Carmichael in his mindset and thinking, saying that John Lewis's mindset and thinking was the right way. And not to trash John Lewis, he's an elder now, he's an ancestor now, but his understanding, his view of being an assimilationist or an integrationist, it was more appealing to Europeans than the mindset of Stokely Kwame Ture. So Clinton trashed Kwame Ture's assessments and opinions to uphold John Lewis's. I think that was a subliminal message to black leadership that, you know, this is the right way to go. And they have a tendency to push educators to do this because they feel as though they're teaching anything else would be teaching some type of hatred or racism. Give me your opinions on that.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing to wage war against a people and then to make it politically incorrect for them to discuss that which is happening to them. So that's a way of making sure that we are never able to get out of the situation.
Okay.
So this is one of the reasons why I think that Kamau Kambone's language of this being a system of terror domination is really, really important. In the field of education, people are, just like the black community at large, is terrorized. So they have shown us that they will kill us, they will kidnap us, they will harm our children, they will put us in jail for no reason and keep you there until your death, they will miseducate us, and they will do in all areas of Dr. Welsing's identified areas of people activity, they will create and protect white supremacy in every area of people activity. Whether we know it or not, and I'm not a psychologist, but whether we know it or not, that creates terror. I mean, it doesn't take a psychologist to tell you that. So then they dominate us. So this is what I was saying at the beginning when I talk about we can know what's best for our children, but we also know that we cannot do what we know is best for our children unless and until the white education dominators say that we can do it. And they have never said that we can do anything that we actually want to do. So we've got those two things working. We got a war waged. It's politically incorrect to discuss the war. We've got a system where we're terrorized and we're dominated, and we're too scared to fight because we're going up against the most powerful people currently, the most powerful people in the world. And they have, we're their number one target. So we understand, every one of us has a bit of fear and terror in us as a result. And then when it comes to our children, and I don't know, I have to find a more convincing way to talk about this, but I think people think of schools as being innocent, fun-loving places.
Mm-hmm. Neutral.
Because neutral and big yellow buses and an apple for the teacher and all these cute little things. But actually what's happening in schools is black children are being turned against black people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This is the reason why black adults, many of us are Negroes and go against black people. This is why Clarence, people talk bad about Clarence Thomas, but a lot of black people are Clarence Thomas minded.
Mm.
Right. And this is where it's created. It's created in the media and it's created in the education system in schools. So I think that I can empathize with people who are more scared than I am, because I was once scared like they are. I think in the field of education, we have to be the ones who are going to be more courageous, because we cannot allow another generation of black people to simply end up like many of us have ended up now, which is simply so scared that it's like, let me just go to work and come home.
In another generation, we won't even be black or African. Especially the way they're moving with this anti-racism, because race doesn't matter. So your identifier, those identifiers will be gone too. You'll just be Americans.
That's correct. And as far as the anti-racist thing, I was just talking to some people about that the other day, and how it's interesting how that has come along right at a time when we might have been able to move the conversation forward by talking about us being African. All it does is make white people the subject of everything again.
Exactly.
So you'll say, well, we have a big anti-racist movement going on. And what we're supposed to say, thank you very much for being willing to consider that you're wrong about us being niggers, I guess.
Mm.
But it doesn't serve us to consistently deal with and work, try to put ourselves in a position where we're always wondering what they're going to do, as opposed to figuring out what we need to do for ourselves and for our future. So that's another crafty bomb being dropped in the war. So every time we try to make a move, these people are thinking, and they're very crafty. They can get black people. They know which black people to support and which black people to really fund. All the anti-racist conversation is another distraction for us. So we are really fighting against a group of people who are extremely good at what they do.
Wow. Dr. Shockley, the narrative of 1619 and the understandings that some of our people push, that our history started in 1619, like we're some type of hybrid black people that sprung up here. How right. dangerous is that mindset to not only believe it, but to teach it to our children? Because, and I want you to really go in on this, because if we do that and buy into that, then we don't have any cultural practices or anything intact. Sure, our people came here and those things were ripped away from them, but they wasn't intact. They wasn't in practice. So when you're trying to tell our children about cultural practices and things of that nature, you don't have anything to tell them. If you tell them, we're some type of hybrid black people that started in 1619. Help me with that. Am I wrong? Am I off track? Clear me up.
Every time I do any kind of workshop, lecture, anything that I do, I always talk about the fact that one of the most dangerous ideas going on in education is that black people's history starts in 1619. Mm. Our history goes back as far as human history can possibly go. And when I'm talking to young people, I will use the marker of Dinkanesh, or as Europeans try to call her, Lucy, when they found her bones. So that's already 2.7 million years Oh, so Malcolm X has it and puts it another way. When you put a kitten in an oven, does it turn into a biscuit? No, it's still a kitten. So in other words, one of the reasons why they have to, well, they want to try to argue, and there's a whole curriculum called the 1619 curriculum.
Yeah.
And I don't know who it is, but somebody's recently got some funding to try to get that curriculum started, either in the U.S. or in some states, trying to get, and it, the idea is to try to spread Black history, but they want to spread Black history or teach Black history from the perspective that the history started in 1619, which would make us really, that would mean that what we really are just the playthings of white people.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So that would mean that we, yeah, like we came into existence just to give them some workers and to support whatever it is that they're trying to do. And to, like, it really just takes away our entire humanity. So no, that's a very dangerous idea. And it's something that we can't stand for. We have to start our history on the continent of Africa where we as a people actually started. And we can go from where they found the bones in the Olduvai Gorge region all the way over to Sudan and then come to ancient Kemet. And then we've got all the history that occurred from ancient Kemet up to the present day. So there's no reason, there's no excuse for starting our history there. Now, there are some Black people within the Black community, though, who are uncomfortable with the notion of us starting our history in Africa because they're not very comfortable with their own racial identity. So we're going to have to deal with the fact that there are a lot of Black people who are uncomfortable with the concept of Africa because they feel as though they're mixed or they feel as though they are not African enough. So they like to push the concept that they're just Black. And that doesn't have any meaning because that's not connected to a landmass with a culture, with a history, with folkways and mores, if you will. That's just a word. But we have to watch it with the idea. So we have to watch this thing where some Black people are uncomfortable with Africa, so they want to sort of not talk about that part of it because of their own personal biological feeling about their own personal and biological makeup. It's incumbent upon us to understand the sort of where we come from and our definite connection to it. And as much as I love our brothers and sisters on the continent of Africa, I travel there as much as I possibly can, we do not need to seek permission from them to be African either.
Right.
We don't need permission from anybody. We don't need agreement from anybody. All we need is the truth. We are Africans, period.
And, you know, one thing, if I may, that in the context of Elliot and Dr. Shockley, what you bring up is that we don't see education as a political tool, and that there is a lot of, especially when you say, well, whether the nationalist community or the assimilationist community, I mean, these people, they're part of a political positioning, and we have to understand that also, that it's education, the educational system, and therefore what is done through it. It has a political intent to service somebody, and in most cases, yeah, is to service the dominant society.
Well, it's 100% political.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why we have schools is because it's as a place to socialize children to sort of reiterate the norms and values of the society and to get them to operate in functionalist ways to keep society going. That's why it exists. You know, the education system in the United States was modeled after the education system in the old Prussia, where the Germans had, the Prussians, if you will, you know, Prussia became Germany, but had lost wars. And the reason they felt like they were losing wars is because their citizens weren't obeying and they weren't, loyal to the government enough. So they changed their education system there so that the people would become loyal to the government. And the United States, under Horace Mann, who was one of the founding white fathers of the education system in the United States, modeled the education system in the United States after the Prussian system, again, which was designed to get people to be as loyal as possible to the nation state. So this is inside of the design of the education system is actually of a political nature. So for us, if what the United States government wants is to maintain itself as a white supremacist institution, then yes, people of African descent have got to have a different idea about what education is going to mean for us, because they're not even trying to educate white people. They're indoctrinating white people, not so much education as it is indoctrination even for the white masses.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with our special guest, author, cultural historian, professor of education, leadership, and policy studies at Howard University, Dr. Kemet Shockley, is with us. The topic, African-Centered Education Theory and Practices, new book. You can get involved in the conversation again by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. When we come back, Richard, I want to play that clip by Professor Mazama in reference to some of the things that Dr. Shockley was talking about. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be wrecked, if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
Not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP of the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
finding courage, let me just say this before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Greene sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:11 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in conversation tonight with author, cultural historian, and professor of educational leadership and policy studies at Howard University, Dr. Kemet Shockley. The book, African-Centered Education, Theory and Practice. You can give us a call to be part of the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We got a few calls on the line here. But before we do that, Richard and Dr. Shockley, I want to share with you this clip, Dr. Amu Mazama talking about homeschooling of black children, if I can get this up here. Here it is.
I have a personal interest as well as an academic one in the topic, because I homeschool my children myself. I've homeschooled my children for 13, almost 14 years now. And so I was interested in what the scholarship said about why African-American people do not send their children to school. We know of, again, the vested interest that African-Americans have had in securing access to public education for their children. We remember in particular 1954 legal battle led by the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall on behalf of black people. And we know that when it happened, it was seen as a great victory for us, that finally we would be able to enjoy the social mobility that is associated with formal education. and hopefully we'll be able to have a better life for ourselves, for our children, and the generations to come. We also know that the 1954 civil rights battle was also the beginning of the civil rights movement and desegregation and end of legal discrimination against Black people. So we find ourselves in 2016 with a very intriguing phenomenon again, which is that Black people now turn their back, turn away from schools and decide they're going to keep their children home. So the question, of course, is why? And when you read the scholarship on the topic, it always says that we're doing it pretty much for the same reasons that white people do it, primarily for religious reasons or maybe safety reasons. And nothing really captures the very unique situation in which African-American people have found themselves in this country. And so my research was about exploring this, especially because as a Black person myself, I know very well why I'm doing it. And I found, after going around the country and asking 74 African-American homeschooling families, why are you doing this? I found that we shared a common narrative, and which is basically that we're trying to protect Black children from the ill effects of racism as it manifests itself in schools, whether it is the curriculum that makes us irrelevant, invisible, or misrepresents us, that makes us really know nothing about ourselves as African people, that makes us even hate ourselves as African people and despise Africa because of the way Africa is presented to us in the classroom or not presented to us in the classroom. And I found that many African-American parents who keep their children home said, and that was very central, that for them to be truly educated, you must know about yourself. It doesn't matter what you know about other people, all the facts that you might have memorized that made you sound smart. But if you don't know anything about your land of ancestry, if you don't know anything about your history, then you are not educated. And they had, therefore, a major objection to what is going on in classrooms of America, which basically disenfranchise Black people and make Black history start in 1619 and reduce a very long history. In fact, the longest history that exists in the world, which is African history, reduce it to basically a footnote in white people's history. And so this is very, interesting because the common discourse out there is that Black people do not care about academic success, that we don't show up for parent-teacher conferences, that the children do not apply themselves. Yet when you talk to Black people who homeschool, and again, homeschooling requires major sacrifices in many ways, financially, time-wise, and so on and so forth. And you see that, in fact, there's a tremendous care about what happens to Black children, and this is why Black parents, keep children home in greater and greater.
Richard, the comments by Amazama, any follow-up with that? Anything you want to mention in reference to that?
No, I'd like to see he had mentioned, Dr. Shakri had mentioned, some of the points that she made, but in her doing that survey, do you think that, Dr. Shakri, that helps in validating the point that Black people are aware of the harm that's being done by public education?
I think it does. I think it's a fantastic thing whenever we are able to do research and find out information and empirical information about things. I think it's wonderful. At the same time, we already do know that we're in a situation where we need to draw on our history, culture, and heritage, and on our knowledge of the fact that we are in a war, in order for a person has to be of that mindset, the things I just named, in order to put themselves around Black children. So we better do that research, but then at the same time, what we're really talking about here is extraordinarily basic. None of this is rocket science. It's very simple stuff. It's what every other group does. It's self-preservation. It's loving yourself. We're the only group when we start talking about knowledge of self, self-love, we better take our kids and educate them on ourselves, et cetera, that becomes sort of controversial, or it becomes a cause for additional conversation. What we're talking about here is very simple. We are the number one targets of the system of white supremacy, white terror domination. And so we have to do something to save our kids from that system. When you speak to slightly more honest white people, they will nod their head, yes, you had better. There's white people who know this. So if white people know it, black people darn sure know it.
And, you know, Elliot, you kind of raised two things came together, as Dr. Shockley would say, that before you go to the callers, that, you know, you raised the question about fear. And I'm kind of in alignment that we have a culture of, you know, trauma, and in that trauma, we have fear. The thing, Dr. Shockley, that I'm wondering also, in the sense of, like, recognizing that white people will acknowledge it, but will not deal with it. What I'm, you know, there is maybe not a lot, and I don't know the statistical number, but there is a lot of black supervisors, regional managers, teachers who are in the educational system, and especially in HBCUs. Would you say that this dialogue in relationship to the harm that public education is being projected by those who are in those administrative positions or who are in the leadership of academic institutions, so that it reinforces what black people in the community, especially those who are, and I'm focused on homeschooling, those who are doing homeschooling for the reasons Dr. Amamazama, do you think that there's a consensus amongst those regional representatives, teachers, who are black and leaders within HBCUs that used to be primarily teaching colleges, that this is so?
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting because when it comes to school administrators and university administrators, black ones, et cetera, there's a lot of effort that goes into making sure that certain types of people are chosen for those roles. School systems, as well as university boards and upper level administration, put people oftentimes into roles that are going to toe the line and are going to just behave in such ways that they are carrying the status quo. You do have occasional exceptions to that rule, but for the most part, what ends up happening is the person who gets those jobs is a person that is looked at as, you had better do exactly what we're telling you to do. You'll be fired if you don't. I know several people who work in school systems that have been fired for trying to do the right thing by black children. One of the things, Asa Hilliard used to rattle off all their names, Audrey Bullard and Tashango and Billy Shaka, fired from Howard University Middle School for doing his job. The lady who used to run Chick Elementary School, I always forget her name. Unfortunately, I had to remember that mama's name from that one, but she was doing a good job over there. They tried to shut that school down. They were eventually able to make headway on getting that school turned into something else because black kids at Chick Elementary School were doing so well. So they tried to rebirth themselves and are now called African American Academy over in Kansas City.
I remember that.
Yeah, there's so many examples of those people who do a very good job teaching black children end themselves in trouble. And, you know, there's a culture of having low expectations for black people. And what people don't know is that culture of low expectations goes from pre-K, where my sister teaches, all the way through the doctoral level where I teach. That doesn't stop at the K-12 level. Low expectations goes all the way through the doctor.
Wow. for. I'm telling you.
I hope the Time for Awakening or listening audience is really clicking on this, because it, in this political moment that everybody's tied to the vote and voting and the lesser of two evils, and hearing, you know, Dr. Shockley say that education is political, that it requires us to be, you know, and that's why I think the book, you know, African-Centered Education Theory and Practice is important for us to be able to tap into, because we have, it's on us to be able to manage, not just let the system, to even select who's going to be in these schools that are close to us, or even what we expect, the expectation we expect that anything for our children should be. So I just hope that you know, what he said, it resonates with the Time for Awakening audience.
Let's take calls. Let's go to 267. 267.
Yes. How are you, gentlemen?
How are you, sir?
Good. Dr. Shockley, I like what you're saying, sir. I'm going to take us back to 1968, 1967. And I had two aunts. One of them graduated from Cheney University with John Skeef, who had the Ombe Institute. The other one graduated with John Skeef in high school. And high school, when I was at West Philadelphia High School, from 77 to 79, John Skeef, happened to be my advisor and teacher. And we knew nothing about history per se, what's going on now. And I can remember when Roots came out, John Skeef wore dashiki, and you know, he was telling us what he thought, what we should be doing, what we should be studying. And I happened to graduate from Lincoln University, and John Skeef was working the Wambe Institute with Dr. Bivens and Mr. Bivens, Ed Robinson, and Uncle Calvin. And from there, of course, he's trying to formulate his school of the Wambe Institute. We've heard how they were in the United States, how the Afrocentric education was trying to be formulated, and they wanted to get out of the public school system because he could not do what he wanted to do. He was one of the first ones to have a charter school with the mindset of have the Afrocentric piece. And in Philadelphia, it's always been hard. It's like anything else. Anything that you want to teach children that's going to help children, especially black children, sometimes it's always absorbed. It could be something with a trade. It could be something with a program. It could be something with teen court. So I'm saying that time goes on now, and I run into a Greg Carr. I was working on my master's in English education after my undergraduate degree at Lincoln University, and he was working out of the Blossom Collection. I said, this is one of the smartest brothers on campus. Every time I stop here to do my papers, we would talk, and I would go where I had to go. And after he got his PhD from the Afro-American Studies at Temple University, he had worked on a course with a few other people to make sure this course was incorporated, not just 1619. They did their best to have it done in Philadelphia. Now, as an educator and being in the public school system doing it, they did the best that they could to try to keep it in the curriculum, but they were fought against. And now when things happen, and you remember, education starts at home. That's how John Skeef started with his children at home. That's how he started at Cheney University in 68 and 67, when they were on them radical movements in the 60s. And under chat right now today, I'm thinking now, with virtual learning, how much of that is going on in your home? See, because education starts at home, Dr. Shockley. That's the other thing. So we got to look at where Philadelphia started off with Afrocentricity in there, or African learning in there, public schools and in their homes, and we'll be going out today. And I'm also going to say to you that, what do you think about virtual learning on Howard University's campus? I'm just told that Howard is going virtual. Is this true?
Well, like most universities in the country right now, Howard is virtual because of COVID.
Okay. Now, at that point, because I had some friends who just graduated from law school, and they were talking about, well, what's going on now? We should just be able to go before the bar. In other words, people I know who in their residency for medical school, they've been giving them a break. So my thing is that a person getting their PhD in Afro-American Studies at Howard University under Dr. Greg Carr, are there any breaks there? What do you think? How should that go? Because here we go again. you're going to be able to formulate and do things in the country coming out of Howard University or any other PhD program, Afro-American Studies in the country. And how better can we get to our people to give them what they need on any level? Because we've been attacked on the elementary school, high school, and on the college level.
What was your question? Yeah, I want to make sure I had.
Ask that question again.
My question to you, how effective can we be broken up like this because things aren't functioning properly? In other words, the virtual learning on the colleges and campuses, there's virtual learning in the high schools and elementary schools. And I'm telling you, can you see us as a group of people giving us what we need to give our children, or do we have it to give it to them? I want to know your opinion on that when it comes to Afrocentricity.
Let me say this. I think that one of the greatest strengths of people of African descent is our love of hooking up, that is, getting together and being with one another and being in community with one another. And one of my complaints, if you will, is about the internet, generally speaking, is that it sort of it discourages that hookup piece that we need to do, that we enjoy doing, that we really need to connect with each other face to face. I think that's really our strength. I think that European strength is what they have created, and that is a world of Snoop being a Snoop and being online and not wanting to directly talk to, deal with, or confront situations and be in building the socialization piece with one another. I think we are operating at a disadvantage when we operate in an online environment that I don't think is really related, though, to the situation right now with the COVID situation of people operating online. Howard University has not become an online institution. It's online now because of COVID, which I think is also the case for most institutions across the country. So I would encourage us to work inside of our strengths and try to find ways to work cooperatively with each other and use African-centered approaches, and also draw from the re-Africanization piece that many authors, including myself, talk about, and that is drawing from the different African cultural groups, indigenously speaking, in the work that we do with one another, and also use what we call an Onipa concept, which is it's a Swahili word, I believe it is, either Swahili or tree word, that means it has to do with strategies for trying to get along with other people within a village. And so there are techniques, and there's a guy named Sanwisye, A-N-W-I-S-Y-E, first name Sanwisye. And his book is called Can We All Get Along? And it has within it some of the Onipa techniques that have to do with Black people finding ways to get along with each other and to work in community with one another. And I'm a part of a group of African people here in the Washington, D.C. area who come together sometimes and try to work in intentional community with each other. And we have access to Baba Sanwisye and his books. And there are elders in your community, I'm sure, who are familiar with Baba Sanwisye. And if not, we can connect you to him. But there are Babas and Mamas in all the communities who know about strategies for helping Black people to get along in their, and because we're going to have to do this in a Pan-Africanist way in order to get where we're trying to get to. I see the issue of us. So the answer to your question is that we will have to have strategies and not think that just because I'm a good person, I should be able to get along with other Black people in the ways that we need to work on our problems with each other, because I do believe what Neely Fuller says, and that is that we come with a certain kind of poison, and we deploy that poison on one another because the ways we've been trained, on the plantation, as Malcolm just said in the speech piece in the segment that we just heard there. So I think that we do have a lot of work to do in terms of us needing to get along with each other. I think it's a dangerous thought for any of us to think that because we're good people, we're easy to get along with, because I think that that's just not true for anybody who has been on a plantation, whose ancestors were on a plantation for as long as ours were, with their humanity stripped away from them. When you're talking about that kind of person, that's the person who needs psychological counseling. That's us. So that happens when we're in community and communion with each other, and we need those Onipa strategies. We need Onyame and Sheshe. We need to draw on, that is an Akan way of talking about the order of the ancestors. We need to draw on our ancestors. We need to draw on the re-Africanization piece and using the things coming from indigenous African culture to be able to deal with each other. If we draw on those things and we do it in an African way and we follow the order of our ancestors, then we'll be able to correct ourselves. We're going to need Ma'at, we're going to need Onipa, we're going to need Onyame and Sheshe, and we're going to need other things as well. So as we draw on all those things, we can get ourselves together. And so, no, I don't think that that can all be done online. I think we're going to have to do it in person, but I don't think we should be doing anything in person as long as we have COVID.
Let's go to 713 in Texas. 713, are you there? 713, Texas. I'm going once, going twice. 713, I hear you. Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to caller. Are you there? Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to 267 again. 267. 267. Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to 646. 646.
Good afternoon to Brother Richard, Elliot, and to your guests. First of all, I really enjoy what you're saying. I think homeschooling is the key. It's been a beneficial to me and those that I know that have done it. I think it's something that, in all honesty, white folks here, I think one of my criticisms of homeschooling is that we haven't put together the right curriculum to be able to move it forward to the next level that it should be at in all facets of the game. Because if most people don't know, you can homeschool your kids pretty much today at ease. It's not as hard as one think it is. To be quite honest with you, most school systems in major cities have a guideline that you have to follow. Now, the thing is, you have to, at that point, I guess, follow a state certification, I think it is, course guidelines. But my thing has always been that you have to do the basics, but the beauty is you can incorporate the other things necessary to educate your children as far as black children go culturally. And I think a lot of times we don't take advantage of it. Now, the thing with this virtual learning today, I find that because of a lot of kids not having access to broadband, computers, and things of that nature, that it's causing a problem. So, I mean, we have to definitely figure out as a community how we're going to, you know, deal with that. But I would tell anybody, I mean, honestly, to never send your kids to the white man to be educated. I mean, it's really no benefit, especially the way this system is set up today. Now, also, sir, you were talking about, I guess it's the 1619 project that was put out by the New York Times, right?
I believe so.
Now, you know the sister that was behind that now is a contributor to MSNBC. So once that happens, you know, once you do the true research of that problem, that project was so incomplete, it's really, in all honesty, embarrassing, you know, to tell the truth. And what made me laugh was they had, I think, a congressman try to put forward a bill saying that schools could not teach that curriculum, which to me, you know, I honestly think it's a joke. I think it's also propaganda, if the truth be told. I was wondering what your take is on that.
Most of the things that come before us that we end up actually seeing, especially if it's in the newspaper or if it's on MSNBC, is something that has obviously been okayed by CIA, FBI, and a various different group of folks who don't have our interest at heart. If something becomes popularized, you can almost write it off just because it's popular, especially if it has to do with the education of black people. So if they're talking about a 1619 curriculum and has made it to MSNBC or NBC, you can just write it off. Then the next thing you do is you want to look at it and say, well, let's just see what I have to do because of the fact that I'm working education, is I want to see what actually is in there. And when you start to look into these things, you start to see that you know, it's just usually a way of getting our children to buy into status quo. And take us,
into whiteness.
Sorry. Into whiteness. So, that's what it is. It's really a way to get us. Now, I haven't seen at any point in time ever in my entire life where they have tried to popularize something that actually would help black children. I've never seen that. So now we send them things, you know, I have graduate assistants who help me and I work with graduate students and we create all kinds of things that we've sent to mainstream, because that's where our people are, to try to be helpful. They ignore every single ounce and piece of it. You would think we weren't even doing anything if you watch them. But they're doing things all the time that they ignore. And the only things they push are the things that have been okayed by the powers that be within our society, which do not have our interest at heart. So I try not to even let myself get tangled up in the distractions that they're creating. They're not going to ever put anything out there into the mainstream that's actually helpful for us. It's just not going to happen.
Sir, I want to thank you. I really want to thank you for saying that, because unfortunately, when most of our people see projects like this, they go Google Gaga over it. But the thing also is, and this is real, people like yourself have to do the critique on it and put the message out there so that our people will know that it's basically bull, sugar, honey, iced tea. Because that's all it is. It's not, like you said, going to elevate us into any type of African consciousness, nor is it going to help us to really be at the point to compete and expose the lies that they have used for so many years. So, sir, I want to thank you. And I just ask that when projects like that come out, can you please do a critique and, you know, put that information out there? Because there's so many people who think that the 1619 project is something that we need, and in all honesty, it's sugar, honey, iced tea. And I'm sorry to say this. Now, Richard, don't get on me too bad, But I know you was a strong supporter of that garbage. You know what I mean? So this is the thing that's so frustrating, that scholars like yourself, and I'll leave on this note, you know, one that y'all were talking about, Greg Carr, and I'll give you a perfect example because I'm hot about it. Here it is. He's somebody that has sat down with Nick Cannon. You understand? I know Greg Carr for over 30 years because I know him from ASCAT and First World in New York, right? Now, he sat down and he's had many discussions with Nick Cannon about all sorts of subjects. Nick Cannon gets in the whole thing in regard to the Jew and anti-Semitism. Now, my thing is this. Why don't our scholars, and I know why, because they don't want to give up that job at Howard, so I'm going to call it like it is. Why don't our scholars stand up and debunk this whole thing in regards to anti-Semitism and Judaism and who is a Semite and who's not a Semite? And I know for a fact what knows the information. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, brother, in regards to him, because I know he's your colleague, but at what point in time are we going to do that? I mean, Dr. Jeffries can do it. You know what I mean? When is the scholar going to stand up and defend our right as Africans to stop being called anti-Semite, someone who ain't even a Semite?
You know, well, let me say this.
Thanks for your contribution. Go ahead, Dr.
I think that if I were to spend a lot of time debunking the things that they're putting out there to create distractions, wouldn't be able to create anything. I would be totally bogged down. I do a little of it, but I have to create these pieces, African-centered education, my other book, The Miseducation of Black Children, the documentary that I created with Kofi Lanials. I have to create these products and the scores of articles that I've created to correct the historical record and also offer a curriculum that's useful to African people, because I'm going to tell you, caller, that writing critique pieces takes a lot of time. And if you, as an African-centered person, if what I did was to critique people who are coming out with various different things that I disagree with, I can guarantee you I wouldn't have time to produce stuff for the African community. I simply would not have time. You would have to then call me a critical race theorist as opposed to an African-centered theorist.
Let's go to Newport News. Are you there?
Good evening, brother. I just wanted to throw in some information. Elliot, you know how I am. I heard the gentleman say, Professor Shockley.
Your voice is a little muffled. Can you get closer, or I don't know?
Actually, I'm as close to the computer as I can be right now.
Okay, go ahead. It's still muffled, but go ahead.
Okay, all I was going to say is quickly, I put it in your chat. I wanted to know personally where 1619 came from due to some other issues with the author of it. But I can tell you what I heard at Hampton Institute, Hampton University, Scripps Communication Center, when Nicole Hannah Jones was being presented. A lady from the Fund 2 Foundation, which is the philanthropy arm of Robert F. Smith, and the Pulitzer Foundation said that they spent 2 years putting that project together. They said one of the incubators was the D.C. school system, compliments of Michelle Reed, and they also said the other that they used as a prototype was Chicago school system, where they first got turned down by the education system, and then they created a grassroots movement that got the parents to lobby for it. They also said, and this is the part I find interesting because I know people at a couple of HBCUs, April of 2019, that curriculum was mailed to every HBCU and 80 school districts in the United States. Most of them under the zip codes called what? Underserved communities. If you leave Elliot your email, I'll send you the information that I collected simply because I needed to know. And I had no idea what fun she was when those two females introduced Nicole Hannah-Jones and said it had been a pleasure working with her over the last 2 years to introduce her. Now, I'll leave this. If you go to her public statement, you'll find out that she came out in December. Came out in January of 2019 and claimed on MSNBC that this was a love affair from her days watching her father fly a flag. I'm just telling you what was said to me in a public space at the Strip Center. Something is not calculating with that. And when you say there's money behind it, Robert F. Smith, only his signature in that Vista Equity that he owns, the flagship of it is proprietary software. Put the numbers together. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for your contribution, sir.
All right.
Let's go to Colin. What's your name? Where are you calling from? Let's go to 215. Question or comment for our guest? 215.
Yes. Good evening, Brother Elliot. How you doing?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Brother Richard and Dr. Shock. How everybody doing tonight?
All right, man.
All right.
Praise be to Allah. I'm going to say good conversation, Dr. Shock. I'm enjoying your conversation back and forth with the callers. Let me say before I get into the gist of what I'm saying is that when Brother Jay called, I understand what Brother Jay is saying, but like you said, Dr. Shock, if you was a critical race theorist, then that would probably be your thing. But like you said, and everybody got their place and they got their place to do their part. So a critical race theorist can debunk these people, and you do what you do, Dr. Shock. You do what you do best, but come up with these programs, curriculums, and stuff. So, with Jay, and I agree with Brother Jay, something it need to be debunked. But like I said, everybody has their place, so a critical race theorist, he can, or him or her can deal with that and stuff, and you do what you do, and you do what you do best, you know. But anyway, I would just like to say this. A person like you, Dr. Shock, is important because at a time, as you well know, and I have to admit, I did just tune in over the last, I think, 20 minutes. I missed a good portion of the show. But at a time, Dr. Shock, as you well know, when you got states like Texas and other states, coming up with this nonsense about slavery wasn't as bad as it was, or some of them even don't even want to call it slavery, and saying it wasn't that bad. And then you got idiots like Ben Carson referring to our people that was in chattel slavery, saying they was not like they was 9-to-5 workers going to work at the Pentagon, or so they was like 9-to-5 workers, hitting a time clock or something like that, with a union protection, the way that idiot described it. So when you deal with this kind of ignorance and just total false information, and you live in this era where a lot of our people getting bad information, people like yourself, Dr. Shock, becomes more important to make sure that we keep everything, totally 100, so to speak, keep everything real and put the truth out there. Because at a time when our children is getting, getting education where it's already bad to begin with, they dealing with Europeans in a lot of cases that teaching them don't have their best interest at heart. That's why people like you, Dr. Shock, even come that much more critical, if you understand what I'm saying,
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thank you for the plug on the work and for the vote of confidence. Let me say this as a strategy, I suppose, and that is inside a war strategy, I'll call it.
Okay.
Inside of a war, so whenever the people who are fighting against you open up their mouths, you should be thinking, this is probably a lie. And then what that does is it prevents you from being distracted by the things they say. Then after you finish listening to them, if you choose to listen, go and do something that's productive, and find something. Read a book on Afrocentric education, or listen to a lecture by somebody that you know is worth listening to. And the reason why I'm saying this is because I think that unfortunately a number of our people in the conscious Black community are being distracted by the barrage of things that are coming at people in this society. So you can have someone, you mentioned Ben Carson, for example, make a statement, and then it goes through a news cycle, and it's on the internet, and everybody's paying attention to it. Well, what has happened in the process is that they've distracted us away from the thing that we should be focusing on. They are at war with us, and they are very good at what they do. So when I come along and I'm talking about something that's constructive for the Black community, it doesn't hit a person who has been distracted. It doesn't hit them as being quite sexy enough for them to listen to half the time, because they're so used to having their ear tickled by the crap coming out of the mouths of the people who run this society. We have to do a much better job of ignoring them. One of the things you can start with, and this is just something I started doing about 15, 20 years ago, is muting commercials if you choose to watch television. So a commercial is trying to sell you something that you didn't ask to be sold. You said you wanted to watch Good Times, that you didn't say you wanted to be sold Clorox. So when the commercial comes on, all of them, mute the commercial. It's a way of starting to practice the habit of not having to be tuned in to all the things that are going on in the society around us that create distractions. We have to practice at it, because they have a way of making all their stuff quite sexy, I'll call it. And then the stuff we really need, it sort of seems like off to the side. Like we put our stuff on the margins so that we can, and we put their stuff in the center because they put flashy lights around it. We have to do a better job in the war maintaining our personal mental space and our sanity.
Dr. Shockley, couple of things, if you got a few more minutes to be with us. I'm looking at the tip sheet here for the book, and it's a passage here I want to read, because I want us to open this up a little bit, because it leads to other things. You got the contributors argue that Black children need an education that moves them toward leading and taking agency within their own communities. Now, let's open that up some, because me and Richard talk about this a lot on the program. And you talked about the enemies of our people kind of play this game on a different level. If you look at it, Dr. Shockley, they're always cultivating leadership in Black communities. They do it all the time. And they use the television and other venues to popularize these people. And I'm talking about political leadership right now. How important is it, from your perspective, that we develop conscious leadership in these communities, not necessarily to run for political office all the time, although I believe that we do need to control the politics of our communities, but how important is it for us to develop conscious leadership in these communities instead of assimilationist leadership in these communities?
It's one of the most important things we can do is to foster conscious African-centered leadership. And the reason I throw that African-centered piece in there is because a lot of people are getting woke and conscious. But unfortunately, that is meaning that they are aware of stuff. It means for a lot of people, they now know who Imhotep is. Okay? They now have an idea of who Queen Hatshepsut is. And I'm afraid if I asked a few questions about Imhotep or Hatshepsut, that some of these folks would actually not be able to answer any question beyond just the definition of who they are, if you will. But let's just take, for instance, the idea that a person is becoming more aware. But if they're becoming more aware through information as opposed to transformation, then what we have is a person who's of very little use to us. This means that if somebody can rattle off African information, but they themselves have not transformed into an African thinking person with a Black nationalist perspective, who is transforming the way they see their community and the way they act and live among their people, then I don't care that you know who Imhotep is. So we have to understand the big difference between information and transformation, and there are no shortcuts to that transformation. So I wouldn't be surprised, for example, if Kamala Harris doesn't mention Imhotep before the election. it wouldn't shock me. But what would shock me is if she decided to become a part of the African community in a meaningful way that demonstrates her the transformative power of what it means to re-Africanize yourself. That I don't think she'll do, because she's not committed to any of that. And yes, we have to have leadership in our schools as well as in our society who have gone on an African-centered transformative journey to change the way they think, the way they act, the way they believe, the way they feel about their people, and the way they interact with their people. That's what we need. Now, we need all of that, and we need the new information. But the conscious community cannot think that it's enough to simply read books and become informed on things. And you people, the younger folks, if any of them are listening, you need a mentor. So you need an African-centered mentor. As my friend, I know if he's listening, he's going to get on me. Let's say a Jegna. Okay. You need an African-centered Jegna to help you understand a number of things. You can't get it online. You need somebody that actually is going to help you understand the nature of the system and the people that we are up against.
You know, your answer kind of cleared up one of my other questions about the difference between African-centered thinking and African-centered education. Let me use that same principle and talk about a plague that's hitting our, and see, listen, this system that we live under here was established in violence. We all know that. But I look at it as a plague that's on our community that wasn't really a part of our ethos, this wanton violence on one another. I'm looking at a lot of these cities, and I'll use Philadelphia as an example, with most of the leadership, political leadership, looks like me, black. But when it comes to solutions for this violence, it's always a multicultural approach. It's gun buybacks. It's everything else besides some type of cultural infusion that'll change the behavior of some of our people. It'll help our young people to give them a base, and it might help some of these older people as far as changing their behavior. This type of solutions that some of our people are reaching for is not going to stop this plague of violence in our communities unless we do a Marshall Plan of where we flood our communities with cultural principles that'll hopefully change our behavior. Help me with that. Am I off course, Dr. Shockley?
Mm-mm. No, you're not off course at all. What it is that because we've been trained by the enemy to think in short-sighted ways that lead us, always are going to sort of lead us to status quo. Now, unfortunately, on this one, status quo is black people dying and getting killed and dying. So that's the status quo, the violence we commit against each other, physical violence as well as neglect violence, the kind of violence that I experienced a few days ago when I got on the elevator with some black folks and I said hello and no one spoke back. Mm-hmm. That's a form of violence against other black people. So that's that self-hatred piece that comes in there that sometimes leads to physical violence and also can lead to self-hatred violence. I think that the African-centered piece and the cultural awareness and the African-centered transformative piece is really the solution. It is the solution to those things. It's not Band-Aid based. But when you have a group of people, namely our oppressors, who want to always push forward things that will take us back to, so it's one way you can always think in this war, the way that they will do things is they will offer solutions that will cause you to come full circle right back to where you started. Not something that is going to actually change it. It's going to actually do a 180 on it. They do 360. So they talk about doing things that are not actually going to solve the problem. But the way we should be thinking is, this is what you can expect in a war. In a war, you can expect somebody to get you to chase your tail. They're not going to come with actual solutions. They're going to come with tail chasing solutions. And if we listen to them, then we will start thinking we're having an original thought when it's the white supremacist putting the thought into our head. So then we end up arguing with black people, missing the principle that Dr. Welsing taught us. Can you not see the black hand and the white glove? Can you not see the black person speaking, but with a white framework and black thinking and white supremacist mindset shellacked over it? Can you not see that? And so we end up in our community taking on principles, thinking, values of the very people who are trying to come after us. The solution to violence in the communities is very similar to the solution to the problem of miseducation. That is, we need to know who we are. We need to practice self-love. We need that African-centered transformative peace, not just information, but African-centered transformative peace. And we do have the right, because we're Africans, to say that that becomes a part of the non-static culture that we want to introduce to ourselves as people of African descent. So we have to have solutions that are about true change and transformation, and we're the only ones that are going to get us there.
Richard, any more that you want to throw out before we...
I don't want to... it was two questions that I guess I had, if y'all don't mind. One is, Dr. Shockley, as y'all put the articles together for the book, was there something... You know, I mean, I know y'all colleagues, and this is, you know, dealing with African-centered education, and not only, I don't know to the degree you had to, you maybe had more submissions than you could be able to put at one time, but in going through it, was it something that hit y'all in y'all discussion about the different articles to make up the book that gave another aha as you were putting the pieces together for this book?
Well, I was trying to think back to think if there was an aha. There were probably several of them, but one of the things that struck both myself and Dr. Kofi Lamoti, the other editor, was a piece that we read that is in the book by Samuel Burbanks. I'd have to look at it to think of the title of it, but let me just look at it real quick. It's a very, very interesting piece called The Biological, this is what Sam is called, The Biological Necessity of an African-Centered Social Support Initiative within the African-Centered Education Paradigm. So what Brother Sam does is he uses biology and his knowledge of science and math to argue that we need an African-centered education because of how black children biologically respond to that information. There's not a lot of pieces that I've ever read, actually, ever. I don't think maybe one other one by Madeline Constantine, who is a psychologist, educational psychologist. But there's just hardly any pieces that talk about the biological necessity. It takes me back to one of my JEGNA, Henry Amy, who is a science and math, a STEM person down in San Antonio, Texas, and the work that he does surrounding the need for black people to increase their science and math knowledge. But I think when people read this chapter, you're really going to find yourself more informed. Just the idea that black kids need it biologically. It's very... very compelling chapter. In fact, I don't have the knowledge to have reviewed that chapter, neither did Dr. Lamoti, so we actually sent it to an African-centered biologist Mm. Check it out, and that's how that piece made it into the book.
And two things that went off my head when you mentioned it, you know, even Mama Frances, I mean, she was basically coming from, you know, the whole thing of the Crest Theory kind of set in somewhat in a biological framework. And then the other thing is epigenetics, you know, saying that, you know, our particular biological and cultural transformation from one generation has to be addressed because of the uniqueness of it. And because, and this is my last question, you know, because when Elliot brought up about violence, and one of the things I had, I was, and come up in an earlier conversation, is Dr. Chancellor Williams, you know, destruction of Black civilization in the sense of African centeredness that speaks to two sides that, and I wanted to get your review in relationship to the educational, being African centered and understanding our long view. Chancellor Williams kind of like in dealing with his historical analysis was placing us, our internal conflict and our external conflict. Do you think that paradigm should be, instead of like focusing, I know I've been accused of maybe celebrating maybe 1619, even though I perceive my view is longer than that. But it seemed that the only one of the persons that really dealt with our internal conflict that we might be looking at now, today, in violence again, not just our self-hate, but just the continuation of us being at old people and having, you know, things that we were dealing with that's not addressed, a part of our African centeredness that we must understand in order to place ourselves, to understand how we deal with nation management in our present, that you have an external enemy and you have had internal conflict that has created weaknesses over different periods in time. Is it possible to look at Chancellor Williams in that sense of as an African-centered historical educational paradigm?
I think so. You know, when you were talking, I got to thinking about W.B. Du Bois kind of does a little bit of that, you know, in terms of his two-list theory. And I also thought of Joy DeGruy and Dr. Patricia Newton and some of the work that they do. But I think it seems like that's a step down the line for us in terms of nation management. Seems like where we are, and I mean, this is just my personal opinion, is more trying to figure out a way to deal with the psychological hurt, the miseducation, and the identity problems that we have. And I think the next generation, it would be fantastic if in a generation or two from now they're able to actually be dealing with nation management. I think, but some of this is related to nation management, but in a sort of cursory way. I think where we are is trying to imagine the possibility, just the possibility of sovereignty at any point in the future, just imagining it.
Yes.
I recall talking to a group of teachers. I was doing some sort of workshop for some teachers, and when I talked about the need for African sovereignty, I lost the room. It was a failed professional development at that point.
I had to say, and I think I brought it up before in time for a week, I was a volunteer board member at a quote unquote African centered school, and we had on the board at that time, it was like two regional managers, you know, people, they retire, but we're there. The discussion came up about multiculturalism. And, you know, and automatically they got into dealing with when you say multicultural, it got into dealing with other people, Chinese, Europeans, this, that, and other. And I'm saying, well, wait a minute. If we're African-centered, talking about multicultural, I mean, and in the school, we had Africans, Caribbeans, you know, people from the islands, you know, from Brazil. I mean, so why do we look at multicultural dealing with those people outside compared to looking at multicultural dealing with within the African experience?
I don't know, but we definitely need it. And we need to fight against the movement to go against Pan-Africanism. There's a movement against Pan-Africanism going on right now. We've got to fight against that.
Most definitely.
But, yeah, I think that people, you know, John Henry Clark said it best, you have no friends.
Mm.
I think we're always looking for friends. We're always looking for someone else to sort of, well, the Latinos have it bad too, so we'll say black and Latino. Well, women are oppressed, so, you know, it's women and minorities. It's all the minority groups. And all those groups do have their struggles, but we're the number one target of the system of white supremacy. And so we're in a different situation, and we can stop looking for friends. Instead, start figuring out how to fight and beat our enemy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was just interesting as you say that, you know, losing the teachers because those professionals could not see, and I'm looking at it from a Pan-Africanist perspective, they just could not see that compared to what the institution said multicultural is supposed to be, you know.
Like the idea of sovereignty is not that. We have to first just imagine sovereignty before we can get ourselves to a position of trying to organize for nation building or organizing for the nation state, if you will, or even just having a space that African people, as Kwame Adjiankoto says, can psychically and physically our own. So psychologically it's ours and physically it's ours. That is probably something that will come second to just imagining the notion of sovereignty, because I think many of us see ourselves as being, we kind of see ourselves as being a part of a larger white show.
Right.
We have the larger white show, then we're in it as a co-star off to the side.
Yep.
We don't see ourselves as running a show of our own and needing to run a show of our own. That is not how the Negro mind has been trained. And so when you try to talk about it in that way, the Negro mind shuts down.
and it's so interesting when you say that, because when you say, well, like, even for those who see themselves and say they can't see that, well, every time you tried to become the star instead of the co-star, then you got shut down or fired, you know? And they just, you know, so it's like the fallback is, well, you know, we'll eventually become the star. They'll eventually let us become the star.
Exactly.
Not in that way, the Negro mind shuts down. Yeah. Well, a lot of us, unfortunately, we want to star in the European show.
Yes. Yes.
But we don't want to star in an African show. So we want this is and this goes back to the idea of looking for a better place in American society. Are we looking for freedom, independence, and sovereignty, or are we looking to better ourselves individually and to move ourselves forward so that we can have the newest Lexus in American society? Which one is it? Betrayal of the ancestors or to pick up where they left off?
Exactly. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Dr. Shockley, let's see if one more caller want to get involved. 267, are you there?
Yes, hello. How are you?
Great.
Good. This is your brother, Joey Harrison. Good morning. Good evening, everyone. Just love the conversation. Yeah, I just feel that it's a lack of self-confidence that we have in ourselves. We just... It's sometimes very, very frustrating. It can be, you know, I work with educators and teachers and parents who are very bright and very smart, but they just don't want that. They just want to be
in the greater white society. They don't want to do anything for themselves. They want to fight to be accepted. They want to be loved. That's what they all really want to be, is love. They're very comfortable being second fiddle or being very comfortable.
Well, when you say love, you're talking about love by white folks. You're not talking about being loved by one another.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, that's what they want to be loved by. Who are loved by white folks? That's what they want to be loved. And it's okay. But that's really what they really want.
To be honest, that's not okay because it's killing our children. It's literally killing our children.
It's killing their children. Not with the parents. It's killing their children. And it's no self-confidence. And you need to, so the fact that you work on these committees with these parents or whatever, and say, well, let's build something up to build up the cultural esteem of the kid. Oh, no. They want to change the adults instead of arming the kids against the society. I mean, you know, sure, we're here to get along with friends and have friends and, you know, and to make it. But it's just, the parents, I think, do not want to arm the kids. They want to train the teachers. They want to talk to the police. They want to talk to the administrators. They want everybody to do actually the work that they need to be doing themselves. And that's raising their own kids with their own sense of consciousness. And as an older parent, it's in my opinion, I'm going to say to folks that may be a little bit younger than me, in the 40s and 50s or 30s, I think a lot of them grew up integrated. And they grew up in a different place, so they really don't even understand. We're talking about African sovereignty, African independence, or having doing your own thing. It's hard for them to conceive it. It's hard for them to even conceive functioning outside of the white paradigm, in my opinion.
Go ahead, Dr. Tucker.
They'll have a speaker come to talk to the kids, and it'll be a white woman. And like, why are you doing that? You know, we're in Philadelphia. We are here with Dr. Santi. So why are you going out of the community when you're talking about race and they're experts right here? Oh, they don't want that to have that to happen. You know, so it's a struggle. So you're preaching to the choir with me. And thank you for having them on, Elliot, Brother Richard, and Dr. Shockley. Thank you for your
Well, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying, and I experience it all the time. It really is a deep-seated problem that we have so many people in our community who their highest hope is a better place in American society, and which really equates to ancestral betrayal. They can't see beyond that because, well, and we've got to keep going back to the truth of the matter, we're at war. So what that means when you have a mass of people who are unable to see beyond a better place in society, is that's a signal to you that you're losing, that the enemy is putting their propaganda out there and in place better than you are. But they won't let us teach our children that that's what's happening. So we're going to have the Afrocentric school and homeschool so that we can teach our children that that's what's good. This is the reason why Afrocentric education is the most important thrust happening in our community. Because what it does is it takes our children away from them and away from their systems of thinking and puts them in our court. And so then they can't continue with their projects. Their projects get shut down because they don't have anybody to teach that crap to. Mm. So it's an extraordinarily effective tool for us if we can get the adults to step outside of themselves and behave in an African way and study African history, culture, and go on that African-centered transformative journey. So it's our great – I personally believe that it is our greatest weapon. Because it is about changing the way we think and protecting our children from the enemy, which is the reason why you don't hear them talking about it. They haven't figured out a way to co-opt it. It's going to be difficult for them to co-opt it. It's going to take them a long time because of what it
centered on. It's not centered on them. It's not centered on being racist or anti-racist or centered on race at all. It's centered on us knowing our culture and figuring out a way that we can fight in the war and actually win. So that these perspectives that cause us to be what the last brother, the last caller was just saying, you're inviting a white speaker instead of inviting an African speaker. It takes a mindset of a person and puts it in the right space for us to win. I said this on a show the other day, and I'm going to say it again. In many ways, if you think of the Jews and the Palestinians, and they're at war with each other, but they know they're at war with each other. Nobody is, the Palestinians aren't wondering if they're at war with the Jewish people. They know they're at war with the Jewish people. So they teach their children in such ways that they can prepare for that war and win some of the battles. What we do is we don't prepare our children to be to think of themselves in war, and we give in where it's difficult. And in that giving in, we give up a lot because we're scared. We don't want our kids walking around thinking of themselves as being in a war that they're partly responsible for helping us to figure out a way how we can win. So I think what we do with the brother that just called is what he should do, in my opinion, is start talking to people about the nature of the war that we're in so that we can start getting ourselves in a mindset of winning.
And I would like to offer something else I see in the review, but because there, and I know you gave an observation of certain African-centered schools that are existing, but I'm thinking of Marcus Klein, I'm thinking the brother that's in Chiki Akua, you mentioned here about the Garvey School, the Ngun Shule. I'm assuming these are formations. If you look at it from a perspective, these are social formations and individual systems that are in place that need support to be able to scale up and just to move from one generation to the next. And if we we feel frustrated, and I'm throwing this out as a projection, as also in my belief, if we feel frustrated in what's around in the broader, we can at least, because I want to believe that they will receive the African-centered paradigm as it relates to education, and they're willing to accept the training. But they also need other types of support that we recognize the difficulty in dealing with the broader society. I'm not saying giving up, but I'm saying we have to, in war, you have to evaluate your energy and resources in order to make the supply line be most effective for the outcome.
Right.
You know, and I think that you know, and that goes to your point, that once we can elevate our discussion to think from that perspective, no, we might not even be able to do it, but at least like we do here on Time for Awakening, we bring people in who are doing this work and always are looking for support, you know, in the case of being able to present the body of work that you're working on so that we can review it and then be able to pass it on to support systems that are in need. Because I've seen great African-centered schools fall to the waistline, not because the people weren't trying to do it, because they didn't have enough resources.
That's right. We have to put our money where our mouth is. That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me try to squeeze two more in, Dr. Shockley. Hold on a second. Let's go to Durham, North Carolina. Durham, question or comment for our guest?
Just listening.
Okay. Let's go to Missouri. 314.
Hey, Elliot, I enjoy you guys as always. You guys do a fantastic job. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think one of the things that Richard always brings up, I think, is not being considered, and that is the impact of colonization. What we're looking at as African-Americans is a colonization of people who have been here for over 200 years. The longer the colony stays away from the main source, the more it becomes a distinct and different aspect. So I think what we're finding, and now what we're seeing, and what I'm hearing is that let's go back to some of the original sources and assimilate some of those sources, which is great if you're in a if you're in a separate entity. But if you're inside a multicultural mix and you're trying to, say, adopt Afrocentric aspects, you're competing with the environment in which they're in. So right now, if you took us back to Africa to, say, assimilate, that would be a very difficult assimilation for most of us because we've been a part of this colony for so long. Now, there are some things of the African-centric aspect that we have to take, but have we become a distinct and unique colony within ourselves with African-centric aspect, but also other cultural aspects that we've assimilated over these many years? Are we now like a mutation that has become uniquely different with similarities to both Africa and to other aspects? And is it incumbent upon us to recognize the uniqueness of who we've become and move forward from that? Because trying to teach me how to become Afrocentric, assimilate that, and then for 57 years I've been assimilated into this colony aspect, it's quite a change. And, you know, I'm not saying it can't be done, but that is quite a change. And then to teach my child to become Afrocentric in that aspect, that's quite a challenge too. Now, I teach them some of those aspects of life, but this colony aspect, I think we can't underplay that. We have been away from many of these things for a very, very long time. Unique, diverse, with those characteristics, different but very similar in all aspects. We're not white. We're not black. We become our own unique aspect. Well, we become in some cases. Well, I want to hear his perspective on that.
Go ahead, Dr. Shockey.
Well, I'll just start off with what I thought was the first comment, and that was about the difficulty of working against a society that you're in because it's a multicultural society. You're already working against the society that you're in. And what we're talking about doing is working against, we're really talking about working for. You're working for your own preservation, working for the upliftment of your community. Other people may experience that as you working against the society. And trust me, I know they will because they think that's what I'm doing. But what I'm doing is saying, well, you're the one who disrupted us. What we're trying to do on the Afrocentric side is simply trying to rebuild us. The other point having to do with who are we Africans? And I think the issue there it has to do with sort of an identity piece that this is the reason why I say it's so incredibly important to go on the journey. A person has to go on a transformative journey of consciousness building and cultural reattachment and re-Africanization so that they can see and feel for themselves who and what it is that they are. Now, regardless of how many years it's been since we were behaving in ways that make any sense, doesn't make any difference if a dog is away from other dogs for a century or for four centuries, it's still a dog. It doesn't matter of the fact that we have been taken away from our cultural traditions. We can still learn them. We can still attach to them. So I think I don't advise that what we do is to become an intentional intellectual mutt, even though we have been intellectually molested. So I don't think that our position should be let's just give in to the fact that these people have molested us. Our position instead should be who actually are we? And the answer to that is a very easy one. We are Africans, period. It might be difficult for you to connect back to who you are, but are you connecting to being an American? Are you connecting to being a chocolate-dipped European? are you connecting to being the things that they say they want us to be, a nigger? How much are you connecting to that? Those things are hard to connect to, too. You have to force yourself into being all of that stuff. None of that stuff is natural. The most natural thing for us is to focus on the natural. Listen to the words I'm about to say. These are important words. Focus on the natural foundation from which you come. The natural foundation from which you come, not the imposition. The imposition is the thing that the Europeans put on us. I would say you would be, that is again ancestral betrayal to focus on that as a matter of identity. I think the easiest transition we have to getting to something that makes sense for us is to go in the African direction. That's actually the one that's the easiest. When I got on that track, it was much easier for me to understand answers to some of the most difficult puzzles and riddles that life provided for me, not when I thought of myself as a nigger. It was easier for me to get on that when I used to think I was white. And when that didn't provide answers and understandings for me, because I was like, well, if I'm white, why am I being treated this way by my high school classmates? Because I'm not white. Once I understood myself as being an African, it began to make sense to me a whole host of things. So I don't agree that it would be easier for us to go in a direction of personal mutilation and to give in to intellectual molestation. I think that what we want to do is go in a direction that presents itself out of the natural foundation from which we come, which is African.
Well, there's two points I'd like to make real quick, if I can. Two points. First thing is, every African country that has been colonized has not been able to regress back to its original identity. It has been tainted. I think the confusion or the question of identity is one of the byproducts of colonization, which is why Europeans promoted colonizations, to take away the very identity of it. It is an effective process, is basically what it is. Those who have been colonized begin to identify and create a culture within themselves that takes away the good from all aspects of where they are, that's when they become a powerful nation. But the colonization process was intentional, is very effective, and it worked in the U.S. We are the subjective, the lesser of a colonization, because we were in servitude on a colonized group, and who are now looking for our place within that. And our place within that is not to be like them, but to be uniquely different in our own aspect of who we want to be. And I think that's what we're battling for. I can't go back and become the African that my ancestors was. I'm uniquely different in many aspects, but I'm also very similar in other aspects. So I'm looking at my identity of African uniqueness and where my future wants to be is what I'm looking at, as opposed to trying to simulate. If I went back to Kenya over 50, 100 years is not the same Kenya. Neither is Nigeria. Neither is Uganda. All of those have been colonized, have become uniquely different. And they are trying to assimilate into a culture that propels them into the future, taking from their past, the future, and how they fit into this world. And as a black man, that is what I'm looking to say. That is one of my things I take from my African culture. I'm also American. That doesn't mean I'm white. I'm American. But those things I take to create a new culture to propel me in the future, because I've been colonized. Whether I like it or not, I was colonized. My daughters, my family was colonized, brought here, and forced to assimilate. Now, if I was in a separate island where it was just me and my people, we could retain those. But now, we're not.
Yeah, if I can, because I appreciate the perspective. And as I was listening, this is the thing that came in. It's a difference between label and identity. And you can label yourself and you can construct your identity. And to me, this is where, and you can help me with this, Dr. Shockley, this is where history coming at, which makes it, yes, every people have a particular history which shapes their identity. Now, what they want to call themselves is something else. But the challenge about colonization that is important if we're in a colony, we're in a colony, a system that is set up to degrade and to make us powerless. Is it that we want to stay that way? And the only way not to stay that way is to create a system, right, that would do other than what the system that we're in. But to say that we're, because to be an American, that's an, you could say that's an identity. But the American system is to make African people who they brought here a subjective people. I don't care how many generations that we done went through, we're still subjective, even though our income or our skill sets may be different. We're still subjective. But to stop that using the Afrocentric educational paradigm is the, we would have to create a system so that we be able to protect our children and next generation. I think there's a difference between the system, because the system we're in, and I think in the last 2.5 hours, we've been talking about there's a war going on to maintain us in a system that keeps us powerless as a people, regardless of our identity.
Yeah.
You know, but we can't overlook, as you're saying, our particular history, which is different than the history in Kenya, which is different than the history in Nigeria, which has many different identities. But they have to speak to their particular history, which is different than those who are in North America. I think that we have to be clear that what we're talking about is 3 or 4 different things. But
Richard, you're in the final stages. You're in the final stages now of a colonization where you, the definition of who you are is no longer becoming relevant. The term black, African-American,
I mean, but who? But who's saying? Right now. Where do you come?
30 years ago, it was very solid.
Yeah, but where are you coming up with that?
We're debating it.
Wait a minute. Where are you coming up with that? We're in the final stages of us defining who we are.
Stages of a colonization is to take away the definition of what constitutes you as African, what constitutes you as Italian, what constitutes you as that aspect. And now what we're having in the first time in our lifetime is a debate on the definition of what is black. Once that definition of what is black or what is African is swayed, then you create
Are putting those narratives out. Do you realize that?
I agree that Europeans are putting it out, but it is a strategy. It is a very effective
It is. It's not an effective strategy if you fight against it. Anything is an effective strategy if you just capitulate.
Let me also add to what you just said there. And this is the reason... I think what we're touching on now is really the reason why this whole 1619 piece is dangerous.
Certainly.
What is happening is that we are being tricked into believing that we've been away from Africa for a long time. We have not. We've been away from Africa for 400 or 500 years. How long were we with Africa? How long were we in Africa?
Thousands
of years. Okay. Yes.
Not thousands. Try again.
Hundreds of thousands. Millions, really.
Millions, according to Lewis and Mary Lakey. So we were in Africa for millions of years. Millions. At least 2.7. We've been away for a measly 400 or 500 years, and you're ready to say that our break is that meaningful. That's the danger of a Eurocentric perspective on time and space.
Yep.
Because an African perspective on time and space recognizes that 400 or 500 years is 2 seconds.
I know it. Nothing at all.
And the Africanisms that we've retained and the connections that we still have to who we are indigenously, you're talking about the non-indigenous attempts that African countries have made to assimilate to European ways of thinking and being. You're forgetting about the indigenous African cultural ways of thinking and knowing that we've carried with us for millions of years. What you're going to have to do is get on an African-centered journey so that you can begin to understand and delve into the ways that we think of time and space so that you can understand the difference between a long time and a millisecond. As Dr. Clark even talked about the little blip, he called it,
mm-hmm.
in time that we've been outside of our African cultural space. I think that your analysis is absent of the actual historical information that is called for.
And I would add again, Zora Neale Hurston's book, Barracoon, or the last one she did, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, even makes it as far as Africans that are here, because the interview, which was done in 1927, was an African who was one brought from. So, you know, how long does it take to lose yourself? And even if you did, can't you recreate yourself in your own, out of your own will and image, your own will to what you want to be, which is what Mr. Garvey was saying, right? Can we create ourselves?
Joe, I enjoy your conversation as always. It's enlightening. It's always enlightening to talk with individuals, even though you don't agree 100% with each other. But it's the dynamic of the conversation and the knowledge that makes the difference. So I truly appreciate it. And as always,
listen,
I'm
before,
an avid listener.
Listen, before I let you go.
Appreciate you too, bro.
Listen, before I let you go, think about something. Because you were given examples of, you know, we've been away for a couple hundred years. So, you know, we need to kind of resign ourselves to be American, so to speak. And I'm just kind of breaking it down. The Europeans that's here have been away from their motherland almost at the same time they've had us here. They have no intention of separating themselves from being European. They protect that motherland with everything they have. They formed a EU, a European Union, which they are part of. The culture that our people follow, whether it's these European holidays at Christmas, Easter with bunnies and fat white guys coming down your chimney, the culture that you follow is European, not American, is European. So these things, he has no intention of disgracing his ancestors or letting that go. He might tell you that, but he has no intention of letting that go. The stuff his ancestors stole from our people, Socrates and all these others, father of philosophy, he's taught that to you and your children because he's proud of that heritage. Don't buy into this foolishness that he tries to teach black people that, oh, American is a separate entity. That's for you to swallow. He doesn't believe that. Just keep that in mind.
No, Elliot, I agree with you. There has to always be an kinship to the African continent, the motherland. There has to be an kinship to that.
No, I'm talking about more than a kinship. But
no,
go ahead.
No, I think here's what I'm saying. I am an African. I'm an African.
You're still there. I hear you.
Hello?
I still have a kinship to Africa. My children have a kinship to Africa, without a doubt. What I am saying is in the colonization process, when you cross the identity, a biracial person, who decide if he is black or white. That is one of the final stages of colonization where you don't have a clear understanding of which one you are. And I think it's a very strategic and it's a very deliberate process. And I think as we become more and more assimilated, more and more African, we have to bring that aspect to life and more focus on it. But the colonization process is being worked on us. It's very effective. And I think it's a continuous process. It's not just one time. I think it is a continuous process that goes on through time to make you less and less African. And it's been very effective is what it's doing. We're becoming more European than we are African on a daily basis. And that's by intent.
You have to, I think also one of the things you have to do besides focusing on an African perspective on time and space is you also have to understand the difference between the way you think when you have not committed yourself to the African
as I keep saying, the African-centered transformative journey, because what you said there is that we become more European than African. That is for those people who have not gone on that journey, but you can still go on the journey. And see, I was at one point more European in my way of believing and thinking than I was African. Now I'm more African in the way of, in my way of thinking and being. So just because you might be at a place at one moment in time doesn't mean that that's the way it is. So that's the way it's got to stay. That's why we call the journey a transformative one, because we transform ourselves from being what we are into who we actually are supposed to be. Now, the other thing that becomes really critical for anybody who is struggling understanding being mixed or racially mixed is they've got to read Chancellor Williams, because Chancellor Williams has in his book the whole history of the way that mixed people have been used in the African struggle. And so I think that, you know, I'm not sure if you're saying that you're mixed, but for if you are mixed or if anyone who is listening is mixed and that has them having a conflict with what they think they should do, pick up the book, Destruction of Black Civilization, and read what Chancellor Williams says in relationship to that. I would try to talk about it, but I couldn't do it justice right now, not at almost 10 o'clock. But I do suggest strongly reading his piece. But some of the suppositions that you're making about who we are may be more personal observations than they are observations of where especially those of us are who understand the necessity of that transformative journey. It's very different to go on that journey and understand who you are as an African person attracted to and in a situation where you're trying to dig into the indigenousness of our culture and history and who we are than it is to kind of look at it from a more I'm trying to think of the right word to call it. There's a personal observation that you can make. Then there's the observation that you make once you've gone on that journey. You begin to open your eyes and see things that you couldn't see before you were on the journey.
Dr. Shockley, it was great conversation tonight. But let me say this too, and I want you to, you talked about strategies used in war against us, and that strategy that you talked about, the biracial thing, that was a strategy that was employed by Europeans, and it was an effective strategy for them, and it's still being used now.
Yeah. And it was they started using it, according to Chancellor Williams, back during the time of the pharaohs and ancient Kemet. We were dealing with that then, because, you know, and it's a deep piece, but Malefi Asante is helpful when he says that where there is confusion for a biracial person, that the confusion that they experience should not be seen as being a confusion that all people of African descent are experiencing. So sometimes what happens is that when a biracial person might feel as though the way they feel because they feel less connected to the African aspect, then it can be assumed or it can kind of be put out there, and this is something that Europeans have also done, put it out there that all black people are wondering what is the definition of black. And you mentioned that in our conversation, that is something that Europeans have put out there. That is not a question that black people are asking themselves every day.
I know
it. Even when I was at my most sellout self, I never wondered what it meant to be black. Even when I thought I was white and wanted a white girlfriend, Even then, I never asked, what does it mean to be black? That was always clear.
Go there, Dr. Shockley.
What'd you say, Richard?
You ain't had to go there.
I'm just saying, you know, that's not a question for people who have to live every day in this world as a black person, identifiable as a black person every second of every day. That's a question that they ask in African American studies programs because a lot of the people who are leading those programs are confused.
Wow.
And they like the idea of bringing in all kinds of other things, like what is black and why do we not want to be essentialists? This is not a question that the average black person is asking. The average black person is not wondering what it means to be black.
Oh, boy, this is a great discussion this evening. Dr. Shockley, before you leave us, and listen, I want you to come back a little sooner than the last time you were here. I was talking to Richard before you came on. It might have been a year and a half. It was a little over a year and a half ago.
It was about this. A little bit over that because the film came out in, I think it was 2018. So
yeah, we need your contribution a little more often than that. So the door is always open to you. But before you leave us, give us any information how people can get the book, things of that nature. Go ahead, the floor is yours.
Sure. Yeah, the book is available on Amazon. It's called African Centered Education: Theory and Practice. Kofi Lamoti and I are the editors, and we also have a piece in the book. That's the best way to get it right now is on Amazon. If you need to reach me, my email address is KMT. I spell my name KMT, Kemet, .Shockley, S-H-O-C-K-L-E-Y, @howard.edu. And, brothers, I've enjoyed it tremendously.
You know, before you leave us, Dr. Shockley, I just want to put something out, food for thought, because this educational manual is valuable to us. And the times we're living in now has given us an opportunity, whether we want to say the Almighty, whether we want to use the term the ancestors have opened the door for us, this shelter in place. And you can't be in these schools' physical buildings. This is an opportunity for us to really utilize these tools. Now, as an educator, Dr. Shockley, before you leave us, how could somebody best utilize this online type of interaction now as far as implementing some of the things that you're talking about, in just in short?
I think very, 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 very easily. A lot of this stuff is trying to give people tools that they can use, which start with a change of mindset.
Okay.
So as your mindset changes, then what you try and do changes. So it's about shifting the mindset. And then when you get to the chapters that are about actually resources, you'll know what to do. You can actually see that when you are interacting with other people, ways that you can interact with them that are going to be meaningful and move us toward in a direction of understanding who we are as people. So the book is written so that you can have that's why it's called African-Centered Education Theory and Practice. So change of mindset is the theory part, and then the practice of actually being able to use the resources in ways that are meaningful are also there. So, yeah, that we cover that in the book. Some of the chapters are covering that, and I think we do a pretty good job of that.
Okay. All right. Well, sir, we'll be looking forward to your next visit, and we enjoyed you being with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, brothers. You all take care.
All right. Talk to you soon. Richard, you know what we'll do? I'll take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll start winding down the program.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free.
Hang on to the world as it spins around.
All our people righteous by nature, wicked by circumstance, so we are going to try to save our people. Take control of our communities. Anybody that want justice, come out of those parties that won't give you justice, and let's have a justice party and set up our own candidates, run them in the cities. Take down the weak, blood suckers of the poor, and cast them out, and set up people that will fight for justice for us.
Because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusion about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it.
If we are to defeat the European, if we are to master this earth and take back this earth from the European, then we must outthink the European. We must then be creative. That puts the learning emphasis on the how-ness, the how to think as such, and to the use of knowledge as a tool of mastery. So it's a very different kind of thing. As a result, you see, the control and the paternalism of Europeans over black people. You see, the other thing that we must recognize, even if the European becomes good and nice and accepts us and so forth, the fact that he would still be in control creates a what we might call a benevolent paternalism, which still to a great degree helps to maintain this passive mode of thinking and this passive mode of knowledge.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and I want to thank our guest that spent some time with us this evening, historian, author, cultural historian, professor of education, leadership, and policy studies at Howard University. Dr. Kemet Shockley was with us this evening to talk about the book, African-Centered Education, Theory and Practice. Richard, it was an interesting discussion, man. I love some of the comments made by some of the callers. Richard, are you there? Mr. Lawrence, Richard.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, is that me? Yes.
No, I'm saying it was an interesting conversation tonight with our guests.
Yeah, I think it's helpful, you know, as well. Definitely helpful in trying to, as Dr. Shockley said, and I see. You know, the point of being maybe being an advanced guard, but I really believe as we continue to have these conversations, it provides us. He used the term of being at war, but although not, it's not a but, it allows us to be able to think differently from the perspective of not just identifying the problem, but you know, problem resolution of, and even if we're not actively engaged in it, just the back and forth helps us to think of how do we, as I just heard Dr. Wilson say, you know, the how-ness,
mm-hmm.
How do we get out of that, you know, in the construction of identity, an identity or construction of system. We talk about an educational system that replaces what is being done to the next generation, not even looking at children, looking at generation, the next generation. How do we produce a system that will do that? And what needs to be in it? And should it be centered in history and even its culture and being able to inspire young people to take on, as you say, those leadership roles. If that's what, you know, the ideals and the resources will help us do, we definitely need to put it, because the system that we're in each generation gets more and more engaged in showing how much it is destroying us.
Yeah, Dr. Emerson also said we got to outthink them, and we can do that. All we have to do is work together, understand that we're at war, and come up with strategies to counter these attacks. Before we leave, Richard, let me read a couple paragraphs from this article that directly relates to our conversation this evening in a lot of different ways. Check this out before we wind things down. This came from a published report in on News One a couple of days ago. And the title of it was Predominantly Black Christian School Refuses Student with Dreadlocks. A private school in Ohio faces major criticism after parents say the school won't let their six-year-old attend wearing locks. According to the Cincinnati Inquirer, Aston Johnson comes from a family that sports locks, long and proud. However, the Zion Temple Christian Academy in Avondale told the Johnsons that the hairstyle is not allowed at the school. According to Ashton's mom, Christina Johnson, this came as a sudden surprise to the family, considering Ashton had enrolled in the school last year wearing locks, according to his parents. The family had to make a tough decision to comply with the school's rules or send Ashton to another school. They decided to send Ashton to another school. What's disheartening about Zion Temple is it's in the middle of a black community and it's predominantly black school, Christina Johnson says. How can you not accept your own people? The city council approved an amendment to Cincinnati's anti-bias law last year, which bans discrimination based on natural hair. However, the law exempts religious groups. The school secretary emailed the dress code rules to Christina Johnson earlier this month and bans boys wearing braids. I just don't understand how you can be an African-American facility that promotes kings and queens in the heart of the black community, and then you discriminate against people who look like the community, she said. Christina Johnson says that she is now enrolling Aston in Northwest Public School District. While Aston will be sent to a babysitter in Avondale, this new arrangement will extend the commute of their dad, Nate Johnson, by nearly 90 minutes a day. Christina explained that Aston loves to witness his hair growing, saying he likes to look like his parents. When questioned by the Inquirer about how he feels about leaving Zion Temple, Aston raised his forearms in his eyes and held them, simply saying, "Well, I'm sad." So, Richard, you got a young man that was going to a black religious school, Christian school, according to this published report, that was told he couldn't wear locks. He said he liked doing it because his mother and father does it, and he wanted to do it. Now, you come from a so-called Christian school. If you knew anything about the religion they claim to believe in and that Bible that they claim to believe in, all of those people during that period, including the ancient Hebrews, several of them wore locks, according to the text. But you're telling a young man that he can't wear locks anymore. What is that really saying to not only young people, to the family? In your mind, does that relate to some of the conversation we had tonight, Richard?
Yeah, and unfortunately, in the reporting, they didn't push, or they didn't say they did, in asking the administrators what changed, as she said, the rule from last year to this year.
I didn't read that part, but it said that they tried to reach him, but they were unavailable for comment.
Right. That's the thing, as we hear in other institutions, you know, this thing about cutting your hair or the whole thing, whether it be women or not being able to wear locks. And, you know, and we've seen what flashed in my mind, the incident of the, was he a wrestler?
Yeah, it was a wrestler. That was at a white school. I mean, you expect that at some of these white schools when they see children starting to wear locks. And what white people feel as though that they might be getting some semblance of consciousness. then it has to be stopped at all costs.
But the thing is, those parents were sitting in the, because this was going on, using that example, and I'm tying into this, and as you say, tying into the whole education, black parents, not just his parents, but the other black parents who was watching that, did not jump up and, you know, in any kind of way in protest in that moment and allowed them to cut his hair.
Mm-hmm.
So here, a black Christian institution, for whatever reason, and you give in historical reference, is going to allow him to be denied involvement in institution because of his hair. So yes, it relates to, you know, this system that we're in,
mm-hmm.
that is reverberating the whole ideal, as you say, if it's about that locks give some sense of power or awareness that black people have by having it. Well, even black people who are afraid, or, you know, we can, you know, be, you know, project into that, are feeding into it.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't read that part, but it says in an email sent to his parents, it stated that the hair must be cut to 1 inch short. But when the publication tried to reach out to the school, they didn't respond to requests for comment.
And in the sense of why, you know.
Well, listen, the struggle continues, man. I want to, before we leave tonight, I want to give the lineup on time for An Awakening Media. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. From 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., always interesting dialogue and conversation on African perspectives. I think Brother Oshie was off a couple of days last week after returning. Hopefully he'll be back to his regular schedule if he's feeling up to it tomorrow. So try to tune in 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. From 6 to 8 later on Monday evening, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's from 6 to 8 on time for An Awakening Media. From 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central, with host Dr. Mawia Kamban and Sister Nataki Kamban. From 9 to 10, the first and third Mondays of every month, Conversation Reparations, which is in Cobra's program, and that's 9 to 10 on time for Awakening Media on Monday. On Tuesday, 8 to 10, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 to 9, After 7, with host Shani B. Fridays, time for An Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on time for An Awakening Media. On Saturdays, from 4 to 6, Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. From 7 to 9, later Saturday evening, the Elders of Sankofa with Brother Alfonso Watkins. And on Sunday, time for An Awakening is back from 7 until. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. Children, soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of
to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.